IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Kewalramani, and today I have with me my colleagues Prateek Wagre and Rohan Seth, and we're going to be talking about an interesting new development that's happened in the world of information disorder. There was a new report by BuzzFeed which talked about a memo which was put out by a former Facebook employee who talked about what is called coordinated inauthentic behavior. Now, if that term confuses the life out of you, so does it with me. That's why we have Prateek and Rohan here to explain what all this means to us. But back to that piece by BuzzFeed, he essentially has this memo in which the talk is that there are multiple different examples in which heads of governments and political parties in different countries have sort of misrepresented themselves through fake accounts or have carried out activity online through Facebook to sway public opinion. And this is sort of, these have been coordinated campaigns that have been carried out to either boost your own sort of standing or to undermine your political opponents. And all of this obviously harks back to 2016, 4 years ago, around this point of time. There was lots of turmoil going on in the United States with the election campaign between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And again, we are heading into an American election this November, and all of this activity has sort of picked up. And again, there's lots that's also happened during the pandemic, which we can probably talk about. So without further ado, Rohan, I want to first come to you. Can you exactly tell us what does the memo contain and what are these kinds of activities that are being talked about?
Sure. So it's a huge memo. You look at it, I think BuzzFeed broke the story. It's Pranav Dixit, Craig Silverman, and Ryan Mack. I think we can link the memo in the show notes. But essentially, it's a 6,600 word memo by a former data scientist at Facebook. And it contains basically a lot of explosive stuff on CIB. I think Prateek has a different acronym for it. I'm going to let him say it. But it talks about how there is actually a human, to my head, it sounds like there is actually a human cause of content moderation and what happens when you fail at it. And it's riddled with instances of, of very graphic instances of what happens when you don't do enough or don't want to do enough in content moderation. And it actually takes me back to this thing I was reading by this guy called Tarleton Gillespie. The book is available online. It's called Custodians of the Internet. And in that, the author talks about the challenge that Facebook faces and the civil problems that come with it. And he says that, listen, the sheer amount of content that these companies have to monitor, it's sort of like a big river, and a fisherman is going inside with what's one of those things that takes out stuff from pool? I don't know what the technical term for that is. But the fisherman is
a boat?
No, not a boat. The net thing that takes out stuff from a swimming pool. Anyway, the image is that someone is taking out stuff from a river using a very small device. And the thing is that this is exactly what's happening here. It's that big platforms can't always identify everything that is, present on them. And so they try their best using this very small device to, just crack down on content moderation. Having said that, this memo basically tells us that there is not a lot of willingness even to sort of do well at this very limited method. And it's riddled with instances with problems in Bolivia and in India and so on. And so I feel like this is actually, apathy in some sense from Facebook. I just really recommend that you read the memo because I don't have a lot of words to describe it. It's so gory. But I think Prateek could have some insight.
Once again, I just want to sort of come back to this idea a little bit, right? So I sort of get the point. Yes, of course, you can't obviously use that tiny little net to fish through the ocean. I get that. Yet there is, we're talking about coordinated activity. And for example, in one of the cases that this memo talks about, it takes Facebook about 9 months to act on what was a coordinated campaign with regard to the president of Honduras. Now, 9 months to recognize coordinated activity. In some ways, coordinated activity should be easier to pick up than random things, right? Because the nature of that is that. So with that, I want to come to you, Prateek, about how acceptable is this argument that, look, it's really difficult to do this. And therefore, until we have a technological solution where AI can be smart enough to sort through all of this stuff and create these networks and figure out what's going on, this is just the way the world is going to be.
No, so in fact, I think what this case shows is that, you know, the argument is not something that they can continue relying on, right? Because, like I said, 9 months is too long, right? After an issue was brought, was raised, you know, now Facebook's own PR version of it is that this was not her primary job, and when she was looking at things like this. So, you know, it's hard to say which silo it fell into within the company. But, you know, the point is that, as Ron said, right, it points to apathy in general in terms of wanting to deal with this kind of activity. Right? Now, quantitative activity, while it is a subjective and difficult thing to catch, you know, this clearly shows that it took them way longer than it should have. And, you know, for me, three particular things stood out, right? One was the very clear US Western European sort of bias, right, in terms of their actions and what they consider important or not, right? In terms of processes, the sheer haphazardness or, you know, a lack of structure. It seems like there was a lack of structured internal processes to deal with these kind of things, to escalate them up the chain when you spot something. Again, now this is my inference, right? I can't say for sure. This is based on what was put out there in this article. And the other, I think, extremely damning point was the fact that their responses to them seem to be selective and driven by, you know, what may or may not be a public relations issue, right? And I think that's an issue, right? That sort of takes away from the part of, look, this is a hard problem to solve, because it seems like even what they can do is not being done today. Right. And again, look, if you say this is hard to solve technologically, you know, from what we've seen, you know, going back to that Verge story that I think it was Casey Newton was broken back, Rohan, if you remember that, the content moderation story.
No, I think Casey Newton broke it out, I think 2018, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, correct. You know, we spoke to the condition that even there, even workers in this field have it. It seems like even what they can do, they aren't doing enough of.
Yeah, I just want to add here, and I think I'll borrow from the memo. And I feel like there are problems that come here with just the design of how this organization is operating, in the sense that, look, mistakes happen, work cultures exist, and, you know, sometimes they work with or against you. But in terms of Facebook, when very specifically in terms of content moderation, when the work culture works against you, it can lead to human consequences, right? Very tragic consequences. So the memo says that, well, in the office, and I'm quoting from the author, in the office, I realized that my viewpoints weren't respected unless I acted like an arrogant asshole. I don't know if this is going to be believed or not. But she said that when she asked the company to do more in terms of finding and stopping malicious activity related to elections and political activity, she said that she was told that human resources are limited, quote unquote. And when she was ordered to stop focusing on civic work, and she said, I was told that Facebook would no longer have further need of my services if I refused. So what we basically see here is that someone's tried to actually bring up the civic costs of what they've seen in the recent past. And they've basically been told, look, there are problems Facebook can and cannot work on. And to make herself heard, she had to basically, you know, act like an arrogant asshole. And this stems from this whole company culture. Stephen Levy's book goes into it. Chamath Palihapitiya, read into him. He's I think the epitome of it. He's left Facebook already, but I think there's some warrant to how this work culture needs to at least change. I don't think it's a public matter, even though the consequences are. And I just want to add to just one thing. Reading this book by Cyril Sam and the other guy, I forgot. But it talks about the title is The Real Face of Facebook in India. And the argument it makes is that Facebook generally addresses problems in elections and other areas of content moderation as PR problems and not actually as problems that they need to fix. So they think of this as a PR crisis. And I don't know what kind of merit there is in that. But the outcomes certainly reflect that there is some truth to this. So I think this is a structural problem, and the company may be private, but the consequences are very public.
Okay, so the PR bit of it we sort of got, and Pratik sort of also made that point. And yeah, I mean, this is sort of, we've sort of ended up focusing a little bit on one company, but I want to move away from this one company to try and understand the beast that it is, that is coordinated inauthentic behavior. Now, Pratik, when I hear this term, the first thought that comes to my mind is coordinated. Well, okay, so it must be centrally directed. Inauthentic bots and behavior is about how they're engaging, how they're being directed to engage. Am I somewhere in the ballpark of what this actually means?
You are in the vicinity of it. But again, and just to clarify, right? So the term coordinated inauthentic behavior is a Facebook only term, right? Only Facebook uses it, but it's kind of it seems to have taken a life of its own to describe this sort of activity in general. But it's a term that was coined by Facebook. And what they refer to it as, it's specifically in the context of coordinated efforts to manipulate a public debate, right? And I'm just quoting because the words are important, right? Coordinated efforts to manipulate public debate for a strategic goal where fake accounts are central to the operation, right? So, you know, in that sense, yes, Manoj, what you said sort of describes it, right? And then they further look at two levels of this activity. One is domestic non-government campaign where you're talking about pages that mislead people, etc. And then you have foreign influence action where they try to attribute it to a state-backed actor, engaging in some sort of propaganda, that sort of thing. Right? But that's only Facebook's definition. Twitter, on the other hand, has terms called platform manipulation and information operations, right? So information operations, again, as the name suggests, it sort of points to state-backed operations. But again, it's very hard to define what that is. But to Twitter's credit, they at least put out this data whenever they take any activity, they make this data available. Unlike Facebook, where you just have a few screenshots and few examples that they take. In some cases, they make the data available to various research organizations. But even then, from most of the reports I've read, that seems to be fairly limited, right? Anyway, coming back to the platform manipulation part, that's mainly a spam-centric feature, but it also talks about manipulating public conversation and public debate, right? Interestingly, ShareChat, I'm just using ShareChat also as an example because we are focusing too much on Facebook and Twitter, but they don't have a policy on coordinated activity per se. But they just have a reference to creating multiple fake profiles and saying that, using multiple fake profiles in a deceiving manner is something that they don't allow, right? And so I just want to come back to the term itself, right? Coordinated inauthentic behavior is a very technical sounding term that is technically undefined, right? Because if you look at the various operations that Facebook has, they put out now monthly releases, started off with ad hoc reports, but now they do monthly reports in terms of the kind of activities that they've taken down. There is a very wide bucket that these kind of fall into, right? Which makes you, makes it hard to think that, okay, there are these five check boxes that they look at and they tick off, and that is what CIB is, right? Now, to be fair, that it's very hard to do because operations are always evolving, but we also don't seem to know how they think about it, how the definition changes based on response to various sort of activities that they take. Right. So, in fact, I think that you call it CIB. I think they earlier called it coordinated inauthentic activity. I think it was Alex Stamos who mentioned this on a podcast. But that would basically, that would be abbreviated to CIA. So they couldn't do that. Right. But it can, The term itself has, and this is where the problem is, right? The term itself gives you the indication that is very precise, but in reality, it's extremely fuzzy, right? You may as well call it, and this is what Rohan mentioned, you may as well call it something like I see Batman. No, right? And this is a mouthful, right? Which is basically inauthentic coordinated behavior / activity to manipulate narratives on platforms endlessly. If you might as well call it that because the term itself has no meaning.
Well, that actually has some meaning, right? At least it's telling me about the objective that you want to achieve, which is to manipulate narratives on a particular platform. And that's a very limited objective, given that some of these might actually not just be about manipulating narratives, but also having real world consequences. But on that, I mean, we had this conversation before we started recording also. I was asking you about what these behaviors, firstly, a little bit about what this behavior would entail. Would it entail sort of having one message and multiple different accounts just amplifying that message? So, for example, let's say, you know, I might be wrong in my example, so do correct me. When we were in the early days of the lockdown in India and the Prime Minister had given the call for people to sort of clap outside their balconies or, you know, beat a utensil to create noise, I mean, instantly you had this burst of information about how this is scientifically very, very valid. And this is, you know, now would that burst of information, which was, you know, multiple different messages, but amplifying the same underlying idea that this is scientific and therefore beneficial, would that be a coordinated thing, or would it have to be the same message? So, for example, sometimes you see, one particular event has happened and then one particular line or the same verbatim tweet is posted by hundreds of thousands of accounts. So would that be coordinated inauthentic behavior in that sense, or would both of these come?
Yeah, that's the interesting point, right? So I think the point of, I think, the copy-pasted tweet, right? I believe the term for it is copy-pasta. That we've been seeing that in India for years, right? To my knowledge, it's been, we haven't acted on any of those campaign activities, accounts, right? Because you'd have very prominent sports stars and actors whose accounts who may have been taken down. If that was necessarily treated as an obvious sign of this sort of coordinated activity, you know, subjectively, you think there's a very strong case that yes, that is the case, but it doesn't seem like the platforms are taking action on that, right? To the extent that I think it was Pratik Sinha of Alt News, right? He found the Google spreadsheet or the Google Doc that was being used, and he edited the tweet, and a number of accounts, ministers, etc., tweeted that edited version without realizing.
Right.
But yeah, again, there was no action for the platform on any of those sort of things, right? Coming back to your first example also, that you know, about what was it, 9 baje 9 minute?
Yeah, it was that. Right?
Exactly. Right. So again, there were different messages, but again, it's very hard to detect the sort of coordination because most of it would be happening on another platform, right? And that's the way this sort of would work in India, especially, is that you'll have these WhatsApp groups where the messages go out and people either copy paste them or modify them. It seems to me that they've gotten smarter over the years, right? I don't see as much of identical copy pasting anymore, as opposed to the same underlying message with minor variations to the sentences, right? But it seems fairly obvious to anyone observing these activities that these are likely coordinated, but this is where, you know, the subjectivity of this comes in, right? Because it seems that in none of these cases, platforms have actually taken any sort of action against it. Now, that can be for a number of reasons, right? We can go back to those three things, right? Was whether because it's not the US, it's not Western Europe, they don't care as much. And there's a good case for that because they did actually take action against, I think it was a parody tweet tied to the Black Lives Movement, Black Lives Matter movement, right? A parody tweet that went around being copy-pasted, if that's the term. Twitter took action on it, I think, within a day, right? Things like that happen in India all the time. I'm yet to see any sort of action being taken. Right? So whether they just don't care or whether they don't detect it, it's hard to say. I'll take that pinch of salt if you can't detect it in those cases. But yeah, for whatever reason, they've chosen not to act on those obvious ones, right? So even, you know, the tougher and the more subjective ones of, hey, are they following a unified message off the platform and then coming here and shaping a narrative? I think that's a long, long way away from being targeted, unless there is some sort of, you know, again, there is a PR element to this kind of thing, right? And unless there is some sort of newsworthy thing or something that's likely to earn them a lot of flack, I don't see them taking any sort of action against these sort of activities.
All right. So I have a question for both of you, and we'll try and look at essentially what can platforms do And I was reading about how Facebook essentially talks about its rules being to act against the coordinated nature of the behavior of the network as opposed to the content. Firstly, would such behavior inherently be malicious, or is the threat that, or is the problem that there's a bunch of people or bunch of accounts, or if it's coordinated by bots or whatever, that it's being done in a coordinated manner? Is that essentially the problem? And if that's a problem, well, all sides can play that game. So should networks get involved, unless the content is problematic in itself? And what would even then be problematic content? Because I presume, like you said, a lot of this is very subjective. Somebody writing that, you know, it's scientific if you beat a utensil and the vibrations will kill the virus. How do you understand harm or social damage in that sort of context?
Yeah.
As opposed to somebody saying, you know, directly inciting violence. So how does, and also when all of this then sort of intermingles with the idea of free speech online. So what exactly should platforms actually be looking to deal with? Because I believe this has been one of the debates that's been going on in the US also at congressional testimonies about what exactly can you do and where do you sort of blur these boundaries?
That, unfortunately, I think there's no short-term answer here, right? It's going to be an extremely, I think, messy conversation that's going to happen over the next likely to be couple of years, right? And it's not, and I don't think it's, you know, it's a place where platforms can act unilaterally. There is this whole concept of, I mean, there is this thing, right? They are essentially private governors of speech right now, right? In a sense. So while they are private, you know, do we really want them to be the only ones taking a call on these sort of issues? I think that's where the challenge is, and that's where the trade-off is, right? Because, you know, on the one hand, we're saying, look, these platforms are too big; they can't decide what's right and what's wrong. But on the other hand, we also, you know, start screaming and outraging if they don't take down hate speech quick enough. Right. Now that's always going to be a challenge, right? I think that's the trade-off that we have to decide how to solve. And I think it would be wrong to say that only the platforms should solve it. Well, I think a lot of the responsibility falls on them. They shouldn't be the only ones making that decision, right? Because as you very rightly pointed out, that it's not necessarily the nature of it's not only the nature of the activity, right? It's also the message. Which right now they're sort of spinning it as, hey, we're not looking at the message, we're looking at the nature of it, the content itself. But you know, I don't know how much longer they can hide behind that. Because there's also, and I'm going to start tightly digress and go into another quick example, right? Because I think a couple of weekends ago, there were these riots in Sweden and Norway, right? And almost instantly, that was trending on Twitter in India. Right now, I found that extremely curious because I also remembered something like this happening when the Black Lives Matter, the latest George Floyd, in response to George Floyd, when that started, I noticed a lot of Indian accounts being active. Now, again, inherently, there's nothing wrong with that, right? You're allowed, it's perfectly reasonable to have an opinion on everything else, on everything that's going on in the world. Nothing wrong with that per se. But when I looked into these particular trends, right, which was, I think, Sweden riots, we are with Sweden, and Norway riots, most of the accounts that actually had any sort of location data on them were Indian accounts. I found it hard to find, I did not, in my analysis, at least observe too many accounts that I could have, attributed to a Northern European person. There was just one that was very active. And this is really fun. It was one that was really active in one of the hashtags, but one of its earliest tweets were in Hindi/Urdu in Roman script, right? But it was with a profile of a Caucasian woman tweet saying, "Hey, I am white. I am proud to be white," but unlikely to be a Caucasian person. Then, and I think that's where the problem is, right? It's not an easy problem for platforms to solve. And I think if we expect only them to solve it, we're going to end up with the wrong solution.
Although I just wanted to add one thing. I mean, it's really interesting that, you know, when people look at these things, given that my profile name is China Dude, and I'm clearly nothing close to being Chinese.
All right. I just want to add to what Prateek has said a little bit. To me, it sounds a bit rich to ask platforms to, you know, solve this for us, considering that, you know, the misinformation, fake news, CIB, all of this. I don't see how platforms solve this and this solves being an issue anymore. The thing I want to talk about is that even when you look at how these platforms have been trying to just put out the fires, they're not all equal in how much they can do. And so Prateek mentioned ShareChat before, and we are working on this document that is should be available on Takshashila's website. But Prateek and I were working on this, and we looked at ShareChat's policy towards information disorder, which is a fake news, misinformation, and so on. And their policy basically was that don't do it. So it gives you a little bit of insight into how many resources ShareChat likely has or how much incentive they have in trying to, you know, just cope up with putting out fires. So not all platforms are equal, but having said that, I do think there need to be some measures to hold them accountable. How you divide those measures, I have absolutely no idea. I mean, I read about this day in and day out, and maybe I'm too close to the problem to come up with an idea or a solution how to solve this. But to me, it just seems like this unsolvable problem. That's a very vague note I wanted to add.
I mean, to me, in some ways, right, yeah, it might be subjective, it might be tricky, but I mean, probably one good place to start for all of this, and I presume that's a place where people have already started, which is, you know, apply what applies in the real world to at least on these platforms. You know, what you can't be getting away with in the real world, you shouldn't be getting away with. You know, on any of these platforms. That's at least a sort of first starting point. I mean, for example, whether it's about pornography, child pornography and things like that, when you can apply those standards, you know, at least, and even there may be lots of subjective views on what is objectionable. It might not be pornography, but what is objectionable when it comes to sort of children. And I remember there's a recent controversy about a particular TV show where somebody raised an issue about, I think it's in the US.
The Netflix.
So, I mean, there can be lots of subjective grains in that also. But yeah, at least you can apply what is real world logic to this sort of these platforms. And that's one way to begin with. Then one can sort of deal with, at least find ways to deal with when you see coordinated activity of any kind. I mean, the challenge to me in that sense is that, you know, it would be very difficult to monitor content because it's not just something doesn't need to be obviously abusive, hate speechy. It could be sort of, you know, the dog whistles in the US are very different to the dog whistles in India to somewhere else in the world. And it's very difficult to then therefore get all of that caught in terms of, you know, so maybe that's what, when it makes sense when platforms are saying that we're looking at coordinated nature and we're taking down coordinated nature of activities as opposed to monitoring content, because that will require so much local know-how. So that, in that sense, it makes sense to me, right?
Yeah, so, okay, and that's my point. And the reason I was saying that, you know, you can't, I mean, they can't shy away from focusing on the content is precisely this local know-how point, right? Because today, it's very likely that a lot of these decisions are being taken by people without necessarily without local context, which is extremely important, right? And I think, you know, in the short term, right, apart from continuing to build their capability on the content moderation aspect, right, and sort of in terms of, other than investing more in human resources, to go back to that BuzzFeed article, because this is not something that I think algorithms can solve for us easily. Right, because there is so much context, right, and you see this every day. You have different ways of different and creative ways of abusing people or abusing communities that I come across every day. It amazes me that you know, an algorithm can ever stop this, which is why, you know, I was leaning towards the point that it is important to start looking at the content as well.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Rohan, you had something to add.
I wanted to actually talk about the point that you brought up, Manoj, was just apply the real world standards to these platforms. And I think it's based on my reading, I feel like it's makes sense to say this, but there are very inherent challenges in that argument. Because firstly, let's say we talked about child pornography, right? So thankfully, algorithms are able to manage child pornography or just nudity very well, because it means they need to look for, say, a certain color of skin, regardless of what color there is, and needs to be continuous in nature, and it needs to flag it, right? So we are lucky in that sense that these algorithms are able to handle that. And so in that way, we can actually relate this to the real world and say that, well, if we see actual pornography in the real world, happening, you flag it and it's not acceptable, right? And so that can directly translate into these platforms. But apart from that,
I would actually argue that that seems to be less of a problem, because there is broader agreement on the fact that, hey, look, CSAM in any form is bad, right? I think it's more down to that. Yes, algorithms play a role in it. I guess the lack of contention around that is also a very important point. But sorry, continue.
Sure. Yeah. There's a consensus in saying that, well, this is inherently bad. But the thing is that even when Facebook did try to do this, and so they tried to block nudity, you had breastfeeding mothers that actually rallied against this. And they said that, listen, breastfeeding is a natural act. And if Facebook is blocking all of this, this means that this is also going to be more unacceptable in the real world. So it's going to have real world consequences. So stuff that happens online can actually have consequences in the real world and unintended. So things may not be as simple. And secondly, even though there is consensus when we say that, look, child pornography is bad, so it's not allowed online. Yes, there's no debate around that. But at the same time, if you look at, let's say, something like hate speech, there is evidence to suggest that in the real world, actually, a lot of people get away with a lot more hate speech than we actually, realize. And so we can't mimic those standards online. So I feel like these challenges are actually a lot more complex, and solving them can come up with a lot of unintended consequences, as we see in the Free the Nipple movement. I just recommend reading that book, because it talks about this in detail, the Talton Ulysses book. I think we can link it in the show notes. But the general idea is that it's not as easy to apply these standards.
The other point also is that, look, who decides that, right? In the real world, it's typically the state or a court of law that's making that decision, right? In terms of governing what is allowed or what is not allowed. I guess the question is, do we want platforms to have that same sort of power? Again, and I want to make the distinction, right? I'm not saying absolve them of responsibility. I think it's important to hold them responsible. I'm coming in from the perspective of, hey, do we want to give them that much power, right? Because again, the way I look at it, if that inverted triangle, right, where you have the state, you have platform, then you have society, right? And it's important to consider the things we ask for. Where does that move the center of the balance of power, the center of power in that equation? And this is essentially moving it closer to platforms and governments, right? And so I think it's important to keep that lens also. And this is exactly what makes it such a hard problem, right? Or a wicked problem, as we might call in public policy.
Indeed. That's a fascinating point of view from both of you. I mean, I didn't think of how the conversation on platforms could impact not just eventually individual rights, like you said, moving the needle in a certain direction, but also in terms of the real world consequences of what could become normalized as no longer acceptable because it's no longer acceptable online. All right. So Pratik, I wanted to get one last thought. Again, before the recording started, we were talking about, you were talking about a study that you'd read from the Oxford Internet Institute, if I'm correct. And they were talking about the different countries and sort of activity in different countries. Could you tell me a little bit about that before we wrap up?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was mid-2019, and that this report came out, called Global Information Disorder, right? And they basically said that 70 countries have engaged in social media manipulation in 2019 in some form or the other, right? And at the time that this came out, Facebook and Twitter had attributed foreign influence operations to 7 countries, right? These were China, Iran, Pakistan, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and India. But again, and in terms of the actors that had identified, not just talking specifically about India, it hadn't at the time attributed to any government agencies. They primarily looked at or found that these came from politicians and political parties or private contractors. It is interesting because, you know, anyone can hire a private contractor. There's a backstory there as well. Then there is civil society and citizen and influencers, right? Intent of these operations or these, you know, campaigns, let me call them campaigns instead of operations, was basically supporting the government, attacking opposition, and sowing division, right? Now, I want to come back to the private contractors, because I think that's a little interesting, because this, again, they said Facebook and Twitter attributed these activities, right? And it's sort of, since Facebook is again in so much in the spotlight nowadays, this again goes back to, I think, the disclosures that were made in April 2019, just before the elections, right, where they had named pages linked to the Congress party, but engaging in operations, and a private contractor, right? Now, this was eventually brought out that, okay, this private contractor was, you know, was spinning narratives in favor of the ruling party or of the BJP. So it's interesting in terms of how they choose to report these activities as well. And I think that also makes for an important distinction here.
All right, that's fascinating. So with that, I think we're going to call it a day today. I think we've covered a lot of ground talking about what platforms, the sort of challenges that platforms face, but also the sort of problems that persist and that go unaddressed, and when they go addressed for motivations which may be very different from sort of public good necessarily. But also that some of these things are, like you said, it's a wicked problem, and how do you address some of these things? Lots of different sort of measures need to be taken, and even thinking them through, and like Rohan said, the unintended consequences of all those would be important before we can actually create policies which do these things. And again, the biggest challenge to me with all of this is eventually also that when you might end up finding a solution, you might realize that actual technology has changed,
yeah,
and you need to come up with something totally different, entirely different. All right, so with that, we're going to call it a day. Thanks so much, guys. Thanks so much, Pratik. Thanks so much, Rohan.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst. Or our website, takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.